February the 8th, 2020. This is Deanna Spangola, and I'm broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs. I appreciate you joining me today at republicbroadcasting.org. I've been broadcasting here on RBN for almost 10 years, since October 23rd, 2010. And I'm incredibly grateful for the opportunity. I've had guests on the program who are informative, insightful, and sometimes controversial. So I thank RBN and its owner, John Stadtmiller. I also thank you, my listeners, for giving up your time to listen to the guests. And this isn't a swan song. I'm not leaving or anything. I just think that sometimes we complain about things and we forget to be thankful for those things that we do have. And that's just what I'm doing. So anyway, I invite you to visit and subscribe to SpangolaSpeaks.net, ScreeningSandyHook.net, and please email your questions and comments to comment@spangola.email. Visit our friendly chat room at spangola.chatango.com. You can view our past, current, and future guest lineup at spangola.com, where you will find the schedule all the way back to when I started. Just visit spangola.com, click on the radio schedule button on the left, choose the appropriate year and month. My guest today is Jeremy R. Hammond. His websites are Jeremy Hammond, that's H-A-M-M-O-N-D, Jeremy Hammond, Jeremy R. Hammond. .com, foreignpolicyjournal.com, and obstacletopeace.com. And I will post those websites in the chat room. Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I receive your emails, and they're always very informative. Your work in several areas of interest is very, well, it's insightful, informative, and I really appreciate the work that you do and the people that you challenge because of your knowledge. And you've written several articles lately, which people may find at jeremyrhammond.com. And so give us a little bit of your background as to what caused you, what provoked you initially to start investigating, particularly the vaccine issue?
Well, with the vaccines issue in particular, the main thing was the birth of my son. And so just, you know, in anticipation of him being born, I began researching the medical literature just because my wife and I wanted to be able to make informed decisions when it came to vaccinations. And so I wanted to do my own research rather than just relying on, you know, the small amount of information you can get from, like, for example, the CDC information sheets that the pediatrician will give you. I really wanted to dig deeper than that. And so I just started studying the medical literature and going to PubMed.gov and just searching things and looking for myself to try to see what the actual science says as opposed to what the CDC says. The more I dug, and I had already been kind of skeptical of you know, the public messaging about vaccines before that, before I began really digging into it deeply for my own purposes. But just the disparity that I saw between what we're told in the public messaging about vaccines and then what the science actually says. They're just two completely different and contradictory things. And so the more I dug and after a couple of years of doing that for my own purposes, I was researching, you know, with the journalistic skills that I had acquired studying other issues and researching other topics, Just applying that to researching the medical literature. I had also had some health issues that I had already learned how to read the scientific literature to a large extent, just going to the PubMed.gov to just research my own symptoms and things. And so I was comfortable doing that when it came time to research vaccines. And so, I spent a lot of time doing that, and eventually just got to the point in my knowledge where I just realized, like, I have to write about this. I can't be silent with what I know about the lies that people are told. And so I just felt compelled. And even though, I had published a book in 2016 on the Israel-Palestine conflict, and that's a very important issue to me at this point, I've been writing almost exclusively on the vaccine issue, even though these other issues are very important to me, just because the urgency that I see with the threat that we're faced with right now of our rights being stripped away and violated. Our right to informed consent is under assault right now. And not just in the United States, but globally. And we really need to stand up and face this threat, because, people think that, people who don't recognize that there's a threat to our liberty, have been deluded. And so we need to awaken the masses to the fact that our freedom really is under threat right now.
It's very interesting too, to speak about, this now when the politicians are talking about everyone should have access to health care and here's how we're going to pay for it, and it makes it seem like it's a benefit to have the government take over your health decisions, because that is what this is about also. It isn't just about whether you want to get vaccinated or not. And it has so much to do with things that we never hear about. And I just wanted to remind people, too, that when you're sitting in front of your computer, you don't want to have your network on. So make sure that – or you don't want to have your Wi-Fi on. You can turn your Wi-Fi off so that you don't attract those frequencies and still be on the internet. Okay, so you want to lower your frequencies. That's just something that I do. And I think that you do it also.
Yeah, well, the point that you were kind of just addressing, where they talk about they couch the language sometimes in terms of rights, a right to health care and things. And they're doing this with the vaccine issue. The Maldives is an example recently where the legislature passed a bill essentially outlawing the right to informed consent. And this was praised by the UN. The UNICEF organization. And they're using the language of child's rights, and so they're saying that the children have a right to vaccines.
Right.
And so, but of course they're not saying that. Well, that it should be the child to choose whether they want to be vaccinated. Give the child a choice. It's not that they're obviously not saying that. What they're saying is that the state has a quote unquote right to dictate to every one of us, what is going to go into our bodies and our children's bodies. And so they're not really talking about the child's rights, because there's a UN convention on the rights of the child, and they're saying that this bill in the Maldives brings the country into closer compliance with the convention on the rights of the child. But that's not true at all, because that convention actually recognizes that the right to informed consent when it comes to a child who is not capable of exercising that right in his own accord, because the children just simply don't have, the knowledge and the maturity to be able to make those types of decisions. Well, the duty in that case falls on the parents to make that choice for them. And the convention is very clear in acknowledging that. That's the duty of the parents, not the duty of the state. And the duty of the state, as far as the convention discusses, is to simply make sure that the parents are able to have access to health care. And so if they do want to get their child vaccinated, that they're able to. But this idea that the state can dictate and enforce vaccinations upon parents and the children against the will, both the child, obviously, and, you know, what child wants to get vaccinated, and the will of the parents, is pure tyranny. And this is a threat I'm talking about, where, and this is happening in the United States. We've seen movements toward, you know, they're eliminating first non-medical exemptions, which means that, you know, if you have an objection to vaccination for whatever reason, you know, you could get an exemption. And they're saying now only a medical exemption. In other words, only a doctor can write an exemption if you don't want your child to have the vaccinations and you still want to have public education for your child. In California, they've taken that a step further and actually going, you know, attacking medical exemptions as well. So if the doctor writes an exemption, now it's the state bureaucrats are stepping in and saying, well, no, that's not a legitimate exemption because it doesn't comply strictly with what the CDC recognizes as contraindications to vaccination.
Wow.
The problem with that is that it's such a narrow range of contraindications that are recognized that it's totally inadequate. And we know, I mean, the government has acknowledged, for example, that vaccines can cause brain damage that manifests as symptoms of autism. That's been acknowledged by the government in a case in the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, which exists because there's legal immunity against the vaccine manufacturers, and the program exists to shift the financial burden for vaccine injuries away from the pharmaceutical companies and onto the taxpaying consumers.
Right. Don't they charge for each vaccine in a shot? Because sometimes there are three or four that are combined.
Right.
They charge you 75 cents for each one to
Right.
pay for anything that happens as a result of having that vaccine.
Correct.
And they've paid out millions and millions of dollars.
It's over $4 billion now. Yeah.
Wow.
$4 billion. Oh, it's over $4 billion as of the last time I checked, which I think was in November or so. It's over $4 billion have been paid out to in compensation to families of vaccine injured children. And so, you know, and then, so here you have the government on one hand saying, telling us that vaccines are safe and effective, and on the other hand, they granted legal immunity to the manufacturers against injury lawsuits, and shifted the financial burden, acknowledging that vaccine injuries occur. Including, as I said, you know, the particular case I'm talking about was the case of Hannah Poling, who received 9 vaccine doses at once at 19 months of age and then regressed into diagnosed autism. And the vaccine, it's not a court. Sometimes people call it a vaccine court, but it's not a court because there's no discovery process. There's no jury. It's just kind of this special master's proceedings. But the so-called court in that case acknowledge that the vaccines aggravated an underlying mitochondrial disorder that she had, and caused brain damage that manifested as symptoms of autism. The CNN director at the time, Julie Gerberding, who, by the way, went on after her stint at the CDC to become the president of Merck's vaccine division.
Right.
she acknowledged right on CNN that sometimes vaccines can cause fevers and, you know, fevers can cause brain damage. And sometimes that damage can, you know, manifest as symptoms of autism. So, you know, just we have these acknowledgments. We know what's going on. And just the denials that continue to happen. I mean, we're told constantly, oh, you know, the science has disproven the hypothesis that vaccines can cause autism. Well, that's not what the head of the CDC's own, you know, head of this, its own safety division, said in an interview, in 2018 with one of the few good journalists out there on this issue, Cheryl Atkinson. He admitted to her that, okay, that it's a possibility that vaccines might cause autism in genetically susceptible individuals, you know, like Hannah Poling. And the problem is, he went on to say, the problem is that we don't know who those children might be. And it's very hard to figure that out because it requires doing, guess what? It requires doing science.
Right.
Which is something that they seem very reluctant to do. At least good science. I mean, they do plenty of science. Or as James Lyons Weiler likes to say, science-like activities. You know,
right.
But the problem is it's trash. And they're spending all this effort not to find what they don't want to find. And
right.
This is a problem. There's this intentional blindness, this willful blindness within the government and the scientific community, that they don't want to they don't want to ask the right questions. And so, of course, they're not going to get the answers if they're not asking the right questions. And so this is the situation. And it's frightening because, you know, the threat is not, it's threatening our health and our liberty. And you look at the childhood population, there's been studies, one of the studies that I'm familiar with said, you know, estimated that 43% of children, at the minimum, 43% up to, you know, something like 53%, depending on which, you know, the criteria you look at, 43% of children at least have one or more chronic illnesses. We have a sick childhood population.
Oh, absolutely.
But we're not allowed to point to the one pharmaceutical product that is mandated for all children that is specifically designed to alter the functioning of the immune system. And we have all kinds of autoimmune diseases and allergic diseases, and we have, you know, all these chronic illnesses, and we're being told that we don't know what is causing this, but it can't be vaccines. I mean, the one product that's specifically designed to permanently alter the functioning of the immune system, we can't question whether that might be playing a role. I mean, it's insanity. The message that we're, you know, and the things that we're told to believe about what science says about vaccines and how safe they are. It's insane. And when you look at what the science actually says, and just, you know, I could go on and on with examples, but just to give a really salient one is the DTP vaccine, which is one of the vaccines that used to be used in the U.S. It was one of the ones causing so many problems that it was putting vaccine companies out of business. And so that led to the 1986 law that granted legal immunity to the manufacturers, which the purpose of which was to essentially maintain, ensure the supply of vaccines. By shifting that financial burden to the taxpayers so that vaccine companies wouldn't go out of business because of injury lawsuits, and they could go on making,
right.
So that public policy could basically continue because, you know, without the supply, there goes public policy as well. And so it was to preserve public policy and the profits of the pharmaceutical company. Anyhow, the DTP vaccine is the diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, whole cell pertussis vaccine, which has since been replaced in the U.S. with an acellular pertussis component vaccine. But that vaccine is still the most widely used vaccine in the world. It's used very widely in World Health Organization campaigns, for example, used in developing countries. And the thing is that the best studies to date that have been done looking at that vaccine's effect on childhood mortality have found that it's associated with an increased risk of childhood death. It's associated with an increased rate of childhood mortality.
It's also, as you pointed out, it produces the future. It creates a future for these children to be patients for the rest of their lives and to be sick for the rest of their lives, which is very good for Big Pharma. For the pharmaceutical companies,
absolutely.
who are producing all of these other products, and I believe they constitute over 15% of the gross national product at this time. And I also want to indicate that people can sign up for your email newsletters and download a report which is titled 5 Horrifying Facts About the FDA Vaccine Approval Process. So if you visit jeremyrhammond.com, sign up for the newsletter and download that report. Alrighty, we will be right back momentarily after a word from our sponsors.
Change the bad to good, to live in harmony. stars with you and me.
All righty, we are back with our guest today. And our guest is Jeremy R. Hammond. The website is jeremyrhammond.com. And you will want to visit that website, sign up for the newsletter, get the report. And it's also amazing to me that parents do not read and sometimes are not even given the document. It's usually in 7-font lettering. They never ask or receive the ingredients of a particular vaccine. They just automatically accept that the doctor is a professional and that he wouldn't hurt them or their children. And I don't think that the doctors that people go to medical school and it is their desire to harm others. They go to medical school because they initially have a desire to help people, but then they get caught up with the standard of care and paying off their loans, and they are obligated to follow a particular standard of care, an algorithm, and they could lose their license if they do not follow this standard of care. And yet parents, not you, but other parents, just seem to go along. And we have this herd mentality that is unfortunate. And thank goodness for people like you that don't do that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, just in terms of, I mean, people, you know, I think one of the obstacles that people have to kind of information I'm trying to share with your audience is, you know, a lot of people are very, you know, they really believe that what they're told about vaccines being safe and effective, and you know, they kind of question, well, how could all the so many doctors be so mistaken, you know, and it a lot of times there's this idea of some conspiracy theory, you know, the public vaccine policy apologists are always, you know, attacking any criticism as some kind of conspiracy theory. But you just made a really excellent point about how it's not like doctors are all in on some grand conspiracy or something. It's just that there's just these institutionalized biases and these systems that exist, these institutions that exist. Doctors are essentially dictated to about how to practice medicine. And unless they're willing to just completely buck the system and try to go out on their own, then they're going to have a hard time trying to deviate at all from the guidelines that are passed down.
Right.
Like you said, the standard of care. And so, I mean, that's a real challenge for doctors. And I really sympathize. I had one of the few good doctors I've had, for example, had retired, and he told me the reason why is because he can't practice medicine. He's being dictated to about how to practice. And he even though he and his patients, he gave me a specific example of a patient that he had that, you know, required a certain drug and that had been on the market for a long time, had kind of a known good record of safety and it was working for her. But, the regulations and insurance come in and try to tell him, well, no, you're going to use this other drug now. You know, they want to try to switch the medication on him and his patient, even though him and the patient both agreed that the best thing was just to keep using the drug that was working for her. You know, things like this go on and you know, I sympathized with that doctor of mine, with his struggle, and that was the reason he told me he was retiring, because he just couldn't do it anymore. He was just sick and tired of it. And you hear about that all the time, you know, from the good doctors, you know, who aren't willing to just go along with it anymore. As hard as it might be for them, you know, a lot of them to buck the system, they just, and he had trouble too. Like that was, you know, I was trying to get help for my symptoms at the time. And he told me right up front, like he just couldn't, there were things that he couldn't do. As much as he wanted to help me, the system was preventing him from taking the steps that would have been required. And so that's all going on. That's one whole context. Another whole context, you know, you kind of alluded to in mentioning that report that people can get at my website, is just how vaccines get to market and the regulatory, you know, people think that, well, the vaccine's on the market, it must have had rigorous safety studies, you know, that prove that it's highly safe. The problem is that that's not true at all. In fact, you know, people think of drugs getting to market and think that they go through these long-term, large population, large studies with large groups of subjects, and they have the placebo-controlled group to be able to compare rates of adverse events and things. The problem is that vaccines aren't required to go through that type of study. That type of study typically isn't done. In fact, I can say that type of study is never done. There are, sometimes they do use a placebo, inert placebo in the studies, but most often, they're very short-term studies, first of all. Sometimes lasting just days, like the hepatitis B vaccine, the studies, if you look in the package insert, for that vaccine, the studies lasted 4 and 5 days. You know, the 4 and 5 days of follow-up.
Oh my gosh.
Which is totally inadequate. You know, this is the problem, because we're talking about a vaccine here that contains aluminum. The hepatitis B vaccine is an aluminum-containing vaccine. It used to have mercury in it as well, so there was synergistic toxicity. But they removed the thimerosal, which is a mercury-based preservative. But the aluminum is still in there. And of course, there's concerns about the aluminum. Of course, is a known neurotoxin, and so there's a concern about neurologic harm from the aluminum in the vaccine, and there's no human studies, but rodent studies have shown that that's exactly what happens with the hepatitis B vaccine, that neurological harm is caused. And so, of course, when you're looking at 3 and 4 days of follow-up in a clinical trial, you're obviously not going to be able to detect long-term neurological harm from the vaccine.
Right.
And this is a problem. This also, again, goes back to what I was talking about with the DTP vaccine. And how, when they do clinical trials, they have such a narrow, they have these blinders on and they have such a narrow focus, and they look for specific reactions, like, redness at the shoulder, at the ejection site, a sore arm, and things like this, fever, certain kind of obvious things that would be, caused by vaccines. The problem is they don't consider, all these wide range of unintended consequences that might be completely unforeseeable. And so that's the whole purpose of doing a long-term randomized placebo-controlled trial, is to be able to compare health outcomes in general. For example, mortality in general. What is the vaccine's actual effect on mortality? And with the DTP vaccine, they just assumed that, well, if we can reduce the incidence of the target diseases, then we'll reduce mortality. But that assumption has been shown to be false, according to the best scientific studies we have to date, because they didn't consider the what's called non-specific effects. That's the term for it in the literature, non-specific effects of vaccines, which means all, the effects that it has on the long-term development of the child and the immune system and the functioning of the immune system, and all the consequences of those effects on the child. There's things like opportunity costs of vaccination. For example, infection with certain child illnesses in childhood is associated with health benefits. Measles is a really good example of that, because there's studies showing that measles, getting measles, surviving measles in childhood is associated with reduced risk of much more serious diseases later in life, including certain types of cancer. That's an opportunity cost that must be taken into consideration. Public policymakers don't take opportunity costs of vaccination into consideration. They just have this narrow-minded focus on, well, does it reduce incidence of measles? And that's it. And if it does, then they think it's a good thing, but they don't consider all these other effects. Another unintended consequence of mass measles vaccination is a shift in the risk burden. For example, away from school-age children, in whom it's generally a benign disease in developed countries like the United States, and on to different age groups in whom it's more dangerous, specifically infants and adults. And that's exactly what we've seen, where the deaths per cases ratio has actually increased over the years. And the reason for that is because it's not the school-aged children getting measles anymore. So now when there are measles cases, it's more likely to be the proportion of cases are higher among infants and adults. And the reason it's higher among infants is because mothers today aren't as well able to pass in, they don't have as strong of passive maternal immunity. In other words, they're not passing on protective antibodies through the placenta and the breast milk to be able to protect their infants during their vulnerable, initial months of their life.
Right.
And so now, if an infant is exposed to measles, they have they're at much greater risk because they're not protected from maternal passive immunity.
Right. And of course, those childhood diseases actually strengthen the individual's immune system. And once you have, say, chickenpox or measles or something like that, it gives you a lifetime immunity. And as you say, that is passed along from the mother to the another generation, but she lacks that immunity because perhaps she didn't get, she got vaccinated or didn't, but you lose that natural immunity.
So, right, and it's precisely because of the superior immunity conferred by natural infection as compared to vaccine-conferred immunity. That's precisely the reason why, because mothers today mostly have all been vaccinated, and they were never exposed to measles and never had that opportunity. That's an opportunity cost. They never had that opportunity to acquire that robust natural immunity.
Which makes you stronger.
Why. Yeah. Yeah, certainly. And so, you know, we have the question today, you know, of, well, what is the higher risk? Is the risk of measles today for a child in the U.S. greater, or is the risk greater for the vaccine? And, you know, they always talk about, you know, like the death rate in the pre-vaccine era. And you see all the time in the media, the CDC saying that it's 1 in 1,000. This is completely untrue. That for every 1,000 children who got measles, that one would die. That's completely untrue. Because what they're doing is they're taking in the denominator there. They're talking about only reported cases, but they know, the CDC knows perfectly well that the vast majority of cases were simply not reported because measles was generally just a benign illness in children.
Right, right. In fact, they used to have parties. And everybody in a class or the neighborhood children would get together so that they would get the chicken pox and they would have immunity for life, and that would be it. It wasn't a big deal. And the other thing, too, is that people assume that the FDA does all this testing. They do absolutely no testing whatsoever.
Right.
They are paid by the pharmaceutical company to list their product. I don't know what the exact costs are, and the standard of care is set by insurance companies, hospitals, pharmaceutical companies, and the American Medical Association, which is the labor union for doctors.
Right.
And so, people think that the CDC and the FDA, they do all this testing and studying, and so it's safe. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, the FDA relies on the industry's own studies. Yeah, they
right.
do their own independent testing studies, no.
Right.
And, of course, the industry can pick and choose which studies they want to even submit to the FDA, you know? I mean,
right.
the whole system is absurd. And the idea that it's supposed to protect us and keep us safe. The way that they do things, it's not designed to ensure the safety of vaccines.
Right.
It really is.
Well, for instance, on a lot of things, Prozac was tested on under 300 people for a very short period of time before it was released in 1988. So the entire population who may be vaccinated or whom we take who may take Prozac are really the guinea pigs here.
Right, and there's examples of that. You know, like Vioxx is probably the most common one that I see, where Merck's Vioxx drug was on the market and causing problems. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was causing deaths. And so it was withdrawn from the market eventually. But the thing is we know from the fact that there was lawsuits and things and the discovery process that Merck knew about it. Merck knew that this was the potential adverse events associated with their drug. And they just concealed it. They just hid it, and they put it on the market anyways. But the thing is the only reason that was learned was because of the fact that they were legally liable and there were lawsuits and the discovery process with vaccines. That doesn't happen There's no discovery process because the government has granted them broad legal immunity. The only two conditions in which you can sue a vaccine manufacturer, and to be really specific and clear here, I'm talking about manufacturers of vaccines recommended by the CDC for routine use in children. The only two conditions are that if they basically commit fraud by number one, by not presenting adequate safety information and adequate warnings on their package inserts. So if they lie about something on their package insert, or they just, you know, blatantly omit something like a harm that they know is associated with the vaccine, and that was discovered, they could be sued for that because that's fraud. But as long as, you know, as long as based on the data that they have available, they put the warnings in there about the potential side effects and things, then they're safe from lawsuits. And the other criteria is if they manufacture the vaccine that not, you know, in a way that's not according to the specifications. You know, if they accidentally put too much of an ingredient in, a wrong ingredient, or, you know, the virus hasn't been properly inactivated or something like that. If it's not manufactured according to specifications, in that case, they could be sued. That's it. So, unlike, you know, any other product on the market, like, like cars and things, you know, product defects are not a basis for liability in the U.S. for vaccine manufacturers. And so there's no discovery process, and we're not learning all these things about what goes on, you know, within the industry, like we learned about what happened with Vioxx. And so that's another really important point for people to understand.
Right. Oh my gosh. That's just every time that I've talked about vaccines, I just cannot believe that people, the parents, well, I think we've all been guilty of this. We just accept the authority figure and what that authority figure is telling us about a specific product, unless we are the vaccine schedule has increased dramatically over the years.
Yeah.
And it's just mind boggling. I'm just so grateful for people like you who are asking the questions. And you have so many articles on your website about this, about informed consent, and about so many things, the measles vaccine, flu shots. The only time I ever got sick from the flu was I took a flu shot, maybe 10 years ago or so, and it made me sick. And they're promoting it and telling people that you get one, that you get an annual flu shot, which also contains a lot of really, really terrible things. All vaccines contain what I would constitute as poisons.
Yeah, the multi-dose vials of the influenza vaccine can still contain thimerosal, which is the mercury-based
preservative
that I mentioned earlier. And they're recommending that pregnant women get it.
Oh,
pregnant women. And of course, they've never, you know, there's no, pregnant women are excluded from the trials. They don't allow pregnant women into the clinical trials because they say that would be unethical. But then somehow it's ethical to treat the entire population of pregnant women in the United States as subjects of a mass uncontrolled experiment without their informed consent by telling them that it's safe to get the flu shot. This is the kind of insanity that I'm talking about. It's madness in what they're doing. And of course, if you go to the CDC's website and they have a webpage for flu shots during pregnancy, and they say how, you know, that flu shots have a good safety record in pregnant women. And science, they say there's a lot of evidence that it's safe. Well, what kind of evidence are they talking about? They're not talking about randomized placebo-controlled trials. They're talking about retrospective observational studies that just look at population data. The problem is these types of studies, just by their methodological design, aren't really well designed to be able to, you know, identify rare harms from vaccinations. That's the whole, I mean, that's why the gold standard is the randomized controlled trial. And if you look at the study, I mean, I've looked at this, I've read every single study that the CDC lists on that webpage saying that these studies show that it's safe for pregnant women. Not a single one of those studies, not one, supports that assertion. Not one. In fact, if you look at them, it's frightening about the alarm bells that should be ringing to anyone who reads any one of these studies. Like, for example, a couple of them looked at what's called the VAERS database, the VAERS, V-A-E-R-S, which is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. And they just looked at, you know, adverse events after flu shots in VAERS. And it, you know, they looked at, for example, one of them looked at, birth outcomes like, miscarriage. And they found that the rate of miscarriage was actually lower among vaccinated, women. But they didn't conclude. The conclusion was not what the CDC concluded from that. They didn't conclude that, well, this shows that the vaccine is safe. That they didn't conclude that the vaccine is actually protective and will reduce your risk of miscarriage. That's not the conclusion they came to at all. Instead, the conclusion they came to was that this shows that the problem of underreporting of adverse events after vaccination. That was their conclusion, that there's a problem, that adverse events aren't being reported.
Right, because people don't know that they can do this. If they get sick after a vaccine, they don't realize that they can report this because nobody actually tells them that. And as you said, the CDC even admits on their website that the flu shot is not effective. And they admit it, but people don't read. People are more interested in watching entertaining YouTube videos or something. But you have done the study and have read the information and from the people who are recommending it. You have read that information, and the CDC states it's not effective, and yet they continue to recommend it despite this ineffectiveness.
Yeah, I mean, it's the effectiveness of the flu shot. I mean, the Cochrane Collaboration has done literature reviews, a meta-analysis type of study that basically looks at the relevant body of studies and kind of conglomerates that data to draw conclusions, because it's easy to just pick individual studies and just cherry pick the studies that support your position, you know, which is what the CDC does. In fact, a 2010 Cochrane review of the flu shot pointed that out, actually went so far in its criticism of the CDC is to accuse it of deliberately misrepresenting the science to support its policy. The most recent, in 2018, they published a meta-analysis with the flu shot, and then it showed an NNT, which is a number needed to treat, or in this case, a number needed to vaccinate. So what that is it's 71 people need to be, 71 healthy adults need to be vaccinated in order for one to see a benefit from the flu shot.
Wow.
So it's not very effective. In other words, in another way of thinking about that is, for every 71 people who get a flu shot, 70 of them are needlessly putting themselves at potential risk of harm from the vaccine for no potential benefit. You know, that's right. Another way to think about it. And not only that, you know, when they talk about the flu shot being effective, they're looking at, again, mostly observational studies that look at a single season. The problem is that the CDC recommends you get a flu shot every single year.
Right.
And there are very few studies that look at, you know, the question of what is the effect of getting the flu shot year after year after year? What is the effect of that on the immune system, and what are the outcomes of that? And the studies that have looked at that question don't look very good for the flu shot, because what they actually show is that, number one, the effectiveness is reduced each year. Every year you get it, it's less and less effective against flu. The other thing that some of these studies show is that the flu shot can actually increase your risk of illness.
Right.
And the mechanisms for that are, you know, pretty well under, I mean, there's hypotheses that, you know, the biological mechanisms are outlined and detailed. And so, it basically comes down to, you know, without getting really into the technical details of things, there's an opportunity cost. So when you get the flu, again, this is kind of what we were talking about earlier. When you're infected with the flu, influenza, and there's, you know, many strains, potential strains of influenza, and you're infected with one of them, the natural immunity that you gain from that experience confers cross-protection, you know, against other strains as well. Whereas, you know, the vaccine is designed to give some protection against, you know, three or four different strains, depending on whether it's a trivalent or quadrivalent vaccine. And it doesn't, the vaccine conferred immunity doesn't, the vaccine does not confer that benefit of cross protection to other strains. And so by preventing yourself from becoming naturally infected with the flu and gaining that robust cross protective immunity, you're actually, and you're doing that year after year after year, you're actually putting yourself at higher risk of infection with a novel strain. So for example, every couple of years, a new type of strain shows up, you know, a pandemic strain or something that comes out, because the flu virus evolves very rapidly. And so, you know, it's a moving target, essentially, as far as vaccine makers are concerned. And so when one of these new types of strains comes out, people who have been vaccinated year after year after year actually have, you know, they're more vulnerable to it than they would have been had they just, you know, been infected with the influenza and developed their own natural immunity to it. So there's that, you know, there's all these things that public policymakers just pretend, like they pretend like this whole body of science doesn't even exist. I mean, they won't talk about it. They will never touch it. It's like what they like to do is they have these like straw man arguments, and they'll say things like, you know, well, you know, getting the flu shot, it's an inactivated virus. It's not a live virus, so it can't actually cause the flu. But like, you know, like you experienced, you know, but it can cause the side effects that feel just like the flu.
Right. You
know? And then the thing is that they're trying to conceal with that kind of talking point is what they were not addressing is that it, in fact, studies do show that getting the flu shot can increase your risk of not only influenza illness, but also other non-influenza respiratory illnesses.
Right. Absolutely. Correct. All righty. We have a break, a short break. We'll be right back. Alrighty, welcome back. Our guest is Jeremy R. Hammond. His website is jeremyrhammond.com. I will post those websites in the chat room, and please do download his report on Mercury and on vaccines in general. It's very, very informative. And I was just looking up some things here. About when this all started, and also about the the shots, the vaccines that children were given that are so irrelevant. They licensed the influenza B, the Hib vaccine, had 25 micrograms of ethyl mercury per dose. Then they introduced this other vaccine, hepatitis B, which was in 1991, which is ridiculous. Hepatitis B lasts for 7 years, and you have to have, I believe, three booster shots. And just the mercury that you get in those three booster shots exceeded the EPA's limit. And this is horrible, absolutely horrible, that they would give children a shot, infants a shot, that would prevent them from getting a particular having a particular problem when they're children, and would not certainly not be engaging in the kinds of activities that this hepatitis B vaccine would, you know, supposedly stop. But they were well, of course, Merck, as all of the pharmaceutical companies, were looking for a brand new market for their drugs. And not only a market in the human population, but you also have to consider the animal population, which is big pharma too. So.
Yeah, this goes again to the point about the trust that people generally have, you know, among the general population. There's just a lot of faith in the system and in or agencies like the CDC and the FDA. People have this perception that, you know, these agencies exist to watch out for us and take care of us and to take care of our health. But I mean, that's just such a good example of how untrue that is, because what happened is as the CDC kept adding more and more mercury-containing vaccines to the schedule, nobody in the government ever bothered to ask the question, well, what are the effects going to be of the increased burden of mercury on these children?
Because it's cumulative. It doesn't go away.
Right. It was kind of an accident how this came about, because the Congress, it was really unintentional. The Congress had charged the FDA with just kind of assessing kind of just general environmental exposure to mercury. And so the FDA just turned to the pharmaceutical companies and just queried them for information about mercury content of their products. And of course, they got back information about the mercury content of vaccines. And so they finally got around to doing the math. And I think this was probably in 1998 or 1999. And when they did, they realized that the CDC's schedule was exposing infants to cumulative levels of mercury that were greater than the EPA's own safety guidelines. And so this is the whole reason that thimerosal was removed from vaccines in right around the turn of the century. It was phased out, because of that whole scandal. And like I said, the mercury is still contained in flu shots, which they recommend for infants as young as 6 months and in pregnant women, which is recommended to be given annually. So people are still being exposed to mercury in vaccines from the flu shot. And again, the aluminum is in a lot of the vaccines. It's essentially the non-live vaccines generally contain aluminum as an adjuvant. So the purpose of the aluminum is essentially to cause a greater inflammatory response.
Right. And also peanut oil. That's another ingredient. Okay, we'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Guest today is Jeremy R. Hammond. His website is jeremyrhammond.com, and I just posted it in our chat room. And it's just very interesting that and you mentioned before that Eli Lilly tested thimerosal. Some of the people died within a few weeks, and the company published false claims for safety despite the deaths. And their own studies showed that it was toxic to tissue cells.
Yeah, the mercury of toxicity is, you know, sometimes you hear the CDC blatantly lies about this. This is a really good point, because the CDC blatantly lies about it, because the CDC on their website, they say that the form of mercury in vaccines, unlike methyl mercury, which is the form of mercury that you'll find in fish. And so, of course, women are told, you know, don't eat too much fish when you're pregnant.
Right, but do take a flu shot.
But yeah, they get your flu shot. And so they have this, they have this claim that the form is, unlike methylmercury, isn't toxic. That's completely false.
Absolutely.
You know, the FDA, for example, in its own, go to the Institution of Medicine, which has been charged by the CDC and the government with, you know, doing reviews of vaccine safety and things. The Institute of Medicine says that in one of its reports, I think it was the 2011 report, or I can't remember which year it was. There's been so many. Would they come right out and say that ethyl mercury, which is the form in vaccines from thimerosal. Thimerosal is about half ethyl mercury by weight, so it's the ethyl mercury. They say that ethyl mercury is quote unquote a known neurotoxin that can cause neurological harm and quote unquote accumulates in the brain. Their words, accumulates in the brain. It's known. It's known. Just like aluminum is known to be carried by a type of immune cell known as a macrophage. Macrophages can carry aluminum particles from a vaccine injection through the blood-brain barrier and into the brain where it accumulates. Same thing happens with ethyl mercury from vaccines. And here's where the deception comes in, because it's the basis for the CDC's claim that the ethyl mercury, unlike methyl mercury, is not toxic. They say that because the ethyl mercury is so quickly eliminated from the body, it doesn't remain in the body long enough to cause toxicity. That's false, because what they're doing is they're looking at blood levels of the mercury. And yes, it's true that it's readily eliminated from the blood. However, they're not considering the total body burden of mercury. And some of that mercury, you know, it accumulates in the tissue, in the organs and tissues, including the brain. And so mercury is entering the brain and it's staying there. And in fact, ethyl mercury is more persistent in the brain than methyl mercury. More persistent, because ethyl mercury more readily breaks down into inorganic mercury. So ethyl mercury and methyl mercury are both organic forms. So they're attached to a carbon atom. And so the ethyl mercury more readily breaks down into inorganic mercury in the brain, which is less readily able to pass the blood-brain barrier. So it's trapped in there. It's not coming out. And so when they say that, you know, this type of mercury is less harmful, it's not toxic, and it can't cause harm because it's readily eliminated from the body, they're lying, because they know that that's not true, and that's based on a deception and the truth that they're concealing about how mercury does enter the brain and accumulate there. That's what they don't want people to know. But they know that. The CDC knows that. I mean, their own studies. You can go to their website and look at their own studies and then look at the references that they cite, the CDC cites, to support their claim that this form of mercury isn't harmful. And their own studies acknowledge the fact that it's neurotoxic and that it accumulates in the brain.
Wow. It just is mind-boggling.
It is.
literally. Oh, my gosh. And of course, the Congress critters pass all sorts of regulatory acts, like the FDA Regulatory Modernization Act of 1997. And so both parties are guilty of sustaining and propping up things that they know to be, or that they're the lobbyists. There's I think 20 lobbyists per representative in Washington that represent Big Pharma.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest lobbies in the country, no question about that. And one of the most influential.
Right. Absolutely. And so when the politicians, and of course we're all interested, we should be interested in what they're saying and why they're saying it and the, what is behind this free healthcare for everyone is that they want to obligate by law that they own your body and that you have no rights to make any decisions for yourself. Because when you sign up for free healthcare, the government will be able to say to you, look, this is mandated. You have to get this particular vaccine, and they're going to make it a law to force you to do something that previous to the Affordable Health Care Act you would not have had to do. And inasmuch as they have now made it a law, it's out of your hands.
This goes to a really important point that I'd like to emphasize, which is that the risk-benefit analysis must be done for each vaccine. Because, you know, we always hear vaccines, plural, are safe and effective. Well, that's not true. Some vaccines aren't safe and some aren't effective.
Right.
So these invalid generalizations, we can't speak in these invalid generalizations. So the risk-benefit analysis must be done for each vaccine and, importantly, for every individual child. Because every individual child is different, and the vaccine is going to have a different effect on each child. And this is something that bureaucrats can't seem to get through their thick skulls, because they're trying to dictate, and in California is the worst case example of this.
Man,
they're trying to dictate not just to the parents, but also to the doctors.
Right.
What does or what does not constitute a medical exemption. And the problem with that is that bureaucrats in state capitals or in Washington, D.C., have none of the specialized knowledge of the individual necessary to be able to conduct a meaningful risk-benefit analysis.
Right.
And only the parents have that specialized knowledge. Only the parents working possibly in with their pediatrician, in consultation with their pediatrician, have that knowledge. That's it. Those are the only two parties that have that knowledge. The bureaucrats do not.
Right. Well, they have when you go to your doctor, there's a medication algorithm, and it's really a flow chart that physicians access to select the drugs to prescribe according to a patient's symptoms. And this chart obligates all licensed doctors, including psychiatrists, to abide by a specific standard of care, which was developed by only four entities. And it is just beyond belief that so many people go along with this. And the four entities, of course, is the insurance companies, the hospital, pharmaceutical companies, and the American Medical Association. Mm-hmm. And that is what you have to do, or you could lose your license. And I was talking to a physician, maybe within the last 3 years, and she said now that patients don't even have to come to her office to get a vaccine, because now you could go to the local Walmart or the local Walgreens and get your vaccine from somebody that some store clerk.
Yeah. Interestingly, the adverse event, influenza vaccine, there's more reports to VAERS than any other vaccine, and a large proportion of those are for shoulder injuries, because the whoever's administering the vaccines aren't doing it right, and so they're injuring people.
Oh my gosh.
The other problem with that is, you know, if you go to like Walmart or something for your flu shot, and you can't go to Walmart these days this time of year without saying, you know, get your flu shot here. The other problem with that, of course, is that they're probably more likely using the multi-dose vials, which of course contain mercury, as opposed to if you went to your doctor,
right?
You possibly at least ask for the single dose vials, so at least not unnecessarily expose yourself or your child to mercury.
All right. Oh, and I brought up peanut oil. So many children, so many people are allergic to peanuts, and that is because they decided to use it as an additive, because somehow it made the vaccine go into the tissues more, or somehow it created a better environment. And now you have all of these children, all of these people who are allergic to peanuts, who could even die if they have one peanut or if they're exposed in the lunchroom at school to peanut butter. And
yeah, I've, I've read that. I know there's a book about that. I haven't read it, so I'm not that familiar with it. I haven't come across, like, in the vaccines that I've studied, which are, you know, the ones currently on the schedule in more recent years. So I don't know if that's something that was in the past, or what. I just haven't researched that very deeply, so I don't know too much about the peanut oil. I think the vaccines today, I mean, I haven't seen any evidence that there is in the vaccines that are used routinely in children these days. But that's something I would like to look more into, and what that whole story is about. I should probably pick up that book at some point.
Right. It's just very interesting. And you can't inject stuff, foreign particles, foreign things into a person's body, like heavy metals and aluminum,
right,
and all of this stuff into the body, and expect that the body's going to be okay, because as you indicated, it passes the blood-brain barrier, and once it goes into your brain, it's there. And I think so many families have children who are in the autism spectrum, and they become lifetime patients of Big Pharma. Because, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a whole other area that you kind of just touched on of concern, which is autoimmune diseases and how vaccines are associated with autoimmunity. Because like you said, I mean, when you put in these other things in the vaccine and you're injecting it, and the whole purpose of the vaccine is to cause this inflammatory immune reaction.
Right.
And then the body is trained, the immune system is trained to also, you know, attack as foreign the other, you know, elements of that vaccine. And so when you have certain things in there, and like, for example, a flu shot is another good example of this. So in one season's flu shot in Europe, it was found to be causing narcolepsy, which is like a sleep disorder.
Oh, right.
And so the best hypothesis that I've read of that, of why that was happening, is because the proteins from the antigen component of the vaccine, in other words, the viral antigen components, the virus that they put in there, are so similar to a protein in the brain that the body, that certain individuals had this autoimmune reaction, and so their body's immune system was attacking their own brain cells and causing this this disorder, narcolepsy. The 1976 swine flu vaccine was associated with an increased risk of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is an autoimmune disease. It's very much polio-like. It's disabling disease. It causes paralysis. So there's a lot of concerns about a whole wide variety of autoimmune diseases, particularly with the use of aluminum in vaccines, causing, you know, autoimmune diseases. And so that's, you know, a whole other body of concern that parents have, and there's a lot of, you know, studies in the literature about.
Right. It's also a fact that the drug company classifies deaths that occurred during a clinical trial as trade secrets. And for that reason, the company does not have to disclose those deaths to the FDA authorities. So the whole procedure is to immunize the pharmaceutical industry and not the interest of the patient at all.
Yeah, the way they conduct studies, if they don't, like, as I was kind of getting at earlier, if there's something they don't want to find, they can design a study not to find it.
Right.
You know, it's not that hard to do. And the more studies I read, I mean, some of these observational studies, for example, you know, like the ones that we're supposed to believe have proven beyond any reasonable doubt that vaccines can't cause autism. I mean, the way they're designed, interestingly, one in 2015, a study came out, and it was hailed by the media, showing once again that, you know, vaccines aren't associated, you know, don't cause autism, aren't associated with autism, the MMR vaccine specifically. Even they said, even in children with, you know, a genetic susceptibility or with a genetic predisposition for autism. And so the study was looking at, siblings. And so what they noticed was that there was a lower, younger siblings who had an older sibling with autism, we're less likely to get the MMR vaccine. So in other words, what's happening is that parents with an older child with autism are trying to protect their younger child by skipping that shot because of concerns about the shot potentially aggravating the younger child's immune system to develop symptoms of autism. And so this is what's known as a selection bias. It's a very glaring, latent selection bias that they pointed out in the study. And yet, despite identifying this, so in other words, what's happening is the children who are at higher risk of autism are being pooled into the quote unquote unvaccinated cohort in the study. And the authors of the study recognized that and identified it and talked about it right in the study. And yet in their conclusion was that this study shows that MR vaccination is not associated with an increased risk of autism, which is completely the invalid logic because it does not follow precisely because of the selection bias that they identified. Sometimes it's known as a healthy user bias. This has happened with the flu shot. It's another good example of this. So the CDC has claimed that, you know, the flu shot confers a big benefit for the elderly and reduces their risk of mortality. Problem is that the studies that the CDC relies on to make that claim, all observational studies, of course, not randomized controlled trials, they all had a selection bias, a healthy user bias. It wasn't that people who were getting the vaccine were less likely to die of the flu that season. It was that elderly people who were so frail and more likely to die that coming season were less likely to get the flu shot.
Right. Oh, gosh.
Right? And so they look at that and they draw the completely wrong conclusions. And then they market these vaccines on behalf of the pharmaceutical companies to the public on the basis of these claims that are completely scientifically invalid. And that's what they call science. That's what they're telling us. The science proves this and science proves that. And it's junk. It's junk science. And they won't do real studies. They won't do real science that have robust, you know, methodological design.
Right.
They refuse to do randomized trials or a vaccinated versus unvaccinated study. They won't do it.
Well, about 50% of those who sit on the FDA drug approval advisory panels have financial connections to Big Pharma.
Mm-hmm.
And you pointed this out. There's a big revolving door between the Big Pharma and those people who step into a profession within the FDA. It's so apparent that this is just all about money at the risk of people's health. It's terrible. It really, really is terrible. Why don't we take some calls? I'm sure that people out there really have questions, and we could also talk about Gardasil. That's another big issue that is pretty awful, I think. Is the Gardasil scare? Okay, we'll be right back after a word from our sponsors.
With you and me, we all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest is Jeremy R. Hammond. His website is jeremyrhammond.com, and I invite you to visit that website and sign up for the booklet on vaccines. And during the break, I was looking at this peanut oil situation, and that was during following World War II that they began to use peanut oil as an excipient in penicillin, and then later in vaccines, causing the antibodies to peanuts. And supposedly, it increased the penicillin's effectiveness. So
Yeah, that's the whole reason an adjuvant is in the vaccine, is right. to produce, basically it causes a greater inflammatory response, which downstream creates more antibodies. So for licensure purposes, the vaccine manufacturers, this is a really important point, is that the FDA doesn't really, you know, the manufacturers don't actually have to show that the vaccine is effective at preventing the outcome necessarily. What all they have to show is that the vaccine stimulates a certain production of antibodies. So if enough patients have an antibody titer high enough, then they consider that immunity, even though antibodies are neither always sufficient nor even necessary for the development of immunity. So it's really, that's a whole area of scientific fraud on the part of the FDA. So they use this surrogate measure of antibody titer as a surrogate for immunity, even though it doesn't necessarily mean immunity. In fact, measles is a really good example of that, because with measles, certain children who have a deficiency that they're not able to produce, protective level of antibodies, they can still be immune to measles because of a whole other branch of the immune system called cell-mediated immunity. Whereas children with deficiencies in cell-mediated immunity who have a protective level of antibodies, they can still die from measles.
Wow.
And so antibodies do not necessarily equal immunity. But that's the whole regulatory framework, is based on an antibody titer. You were talking before the break about the corruption in the revolving door. And I'd just like to point up to a really good example of that with the CDC has something called the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. So the ACIP or ACIP.
Oh, right.
And so this is the body that basically advises the CDC on what vaccines it should add to the schedule and recommend for routine use and such. And during the time that they were looking at the rotavirus vaccine, one of the guys on the advisory committee was Paul Offit, who might be familiar to a lot of your listeners, because he's frequently cited by the mainstream media as an expert on vaccines. So Paul Offit once sat on ACIP, and while he was on ACIP, he voted several times in favor of the rotavirus vaccine, even though at the same time he was working under a grant from Merck to develop a rotavirus vaccine. So this is the nature, and that's just business as usual. And this is the nature of these so-called regulatory agencies. And the CDC itself is heavily invested in vaccines, in the sense that it's a distributor. It acts as a distribution branch for the vaccine industry. It buys, it negotiates contracts with the manufacturers to buy supplies of vaccines, and then it redistributes them. And then you have the kind of institutionalized schizophrenia in the sense that the Health Department of Health and Human Services, on one hand, through the CDC, is tasked with promoting vaccines and trying to implement trying to reach a goal of increasing vaccination rates. Well, on the other hand, the same department of the government is also tasked with vaccine safety and the VICP, the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, where the government is advocating on behalf of the industry to deny compensation to individuals who petition for vaccine injury claims. I mean, the whole regulatory system is so corrupt and absurd that the idea that we're supposed to trust the government to take care of us, and when they say vaccines are safe and effective, that we're supposed to believe them, is just delusion,
Exactly.
So anyhow.
Oh my gosh. We do have a caller with a question, Francis in Missouri. Francis?
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Thank you for taking this call. I'd like to point out to you something that I found and experienced in 1969 at Vanderbilt Hospital, University of Vanderbilt Hospital. I was able to read the handwritten notes of Jonas Salk, the polio vaccine guy.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, his notes state that there was live polio, dead polio, mutated polio, and approximately 212 monkey viruses. in the polio vaccine. So, are we going to a break?
We're going to a break, but you can stay over the break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest is Jeremy R. Hammond, and we are talking with a caller who is talking about the Francis. We're talking about Salk, and there were actually he developed this vaccine, as you say, that had the SV40 virus. Which was found in the cells of the rhesus monkey. Over 90 million people worldwide were vaccinated with IPV by 1961. And 2 years later, scientists discovered that it contained SV40, which could cause cancer in human cells. And in 1977, he admitted to a Senate committee that the mass polio vaccinations caused not only did it cause cancer, but it also caused most of the polio cases throughout the country since 1961. So, go ahead. I didn't mean to take over here.
Well, what I'd also like, I don't want it to be misleading when I told you about what was included in the vaccine. Not all vaccines had the same ingredients. If you were around in those days, you would have found that each bottle had a numbered code on it, numbers and letters, so that they were able to track the people that got what type of vaccine to see what effect happened.
Oh, wow.
Particular. Now, I do have a particular interest in this, as I've been written up in the newspapers and medical journals. The second time that I had polio, they said that there was less than 5 people in the world to get polio twice. Now, that was in 1958. However, in 1961, I got it a third time. And my mother was paralyzed from the neck down and died after 6 weeks being in an iron lung because the nurse fell asleep and didn't drain her lungs. My dad was paralyzed from the waist down, and my youngest brother, he just had a small damage type thing, a little drooping of an eyelid that went away by the time he was 22. So what they have been doing is using us as guinea pigs for decades and decades and decades. Now, we have to learn of what we did wrong. In other words, I have to ask myself, what have I done wrong in my life? In our society, we're really great at pointing out the problems because there's thousands of them, millions of them. But each of us fails to ask ourselves, what am I doing that has caused the problem? Am I the problem? Well, if we take and we read the Bible, it clearly says we are not allowed to use the blood in any fashion. And so we've all been deceived, and we're not following the Father's law. Mankind has no ability to make law. We are completely arrogant when we think that we can make a law better than the Father. And when we don't follow his laws, then you get to have polio 3 times if you're the only guy in the world that's written up. And it's a real thrill. It's a real thrill. So, you know, I'm not bitter about it. I was stupid. It's kind of hard to fight them, you know, when I was 3 years old getting more vaccines, you know what I mean? But I did fight them when I was 3. And that's another story. But anybody that wants to say, oh, these vaccines, they're being alarmist and extremist and everything, You're buying your own death. You're buying the death of your children. And there's other areas that where you can trace down designed diseases. And it's all through our society, not just with side, not just with medical things, but with our financial things, the things that we eat, and everything that is going on in our society. I have an opinion. It's all over within 10 years. It's wow. Goodbye. We will be back into the Stone Age, and I can't wait.
Well,
that's my opinion.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate you allowing me to talk.
Thank you. Jeremy, your comments on...
Yeah, talking about this, you mentioned SV40, so what that stands for is simian virus 40, so that's a monkey virus, and there is some controversy about that in the medical literature, but there's a lot of evidence to suggest, like you said, that that it's been associated certainly with cancer in humans. And the same thing with the rotavirus vaccine. The rotavirus, that is another example of a vaccine that was found to be contaminated, in that case with pig viruses, porcine viruses. And then, Francis made a really good point that I also would like to kind of elaborate on about just the arrogance of scientists and, you know, whether you believe in God or just, you know, you believe that in evolution, whichever, you know, we were created over millions of years. To have an immune system, and this idea that we all require this medical intervention from starting on the first day of our lives, referring to the hepatitis B vaccine there, you know, in order for our immune systems to function is insane. You know, we have an immune system and it's designed to protect us from pathogens. And instead of looking, you know, what scientists do, they're so myopic in their outlook. And so, you know, what they should be doing is looking at, like, why, for example, did 95% of people who were infected with polio, you know, the majority were asymptomatic. And you know, a lot, and within that 95%, there were also people who had symptoms, but they were very mild and they came, you know, there was no long-term harms from the polio virus. Measles. Why is it that, you know, 1 in 10,000 children died of measles? Most people, you know, most children had measles. Their immune systems handled it fine. They were fine. No long-term effects. No long-term harms. But a certain number of children, yeah, they either were permanently injured or killed by the measles virus. So instead of taking, you know, instead of looking and doing the science and trying to figure out, like, what makes certain individuals more susceptible and then developing targeted interventions, they just have this, you know, this idea that they're just going to mass vaccinate and that's the solution. And there's this one size fits all solution and it's called vaccination. And you know, and this, the fundamental assumptions underlying that, you know, that somehow our immune systems, you know, aren't capable unless we've been vaccinated. I mean, it's so arrogant. Isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. My gosh. Oh, it's horrible. And to hear Francis's story, it's just, and we can replicate that millions of times.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take Mike in Kentucky. Mike, welcome.
Welcome. And, I'd like to, you know, address like three areas here real quick and then we can go back to it. But I want to know if you guys have studied the, allegedly censored section, because I just had my video of mine pulled down again on Brighteon, for the so-called zombie meme that keeps rearing its ugly head as one article tried to, you know, debunk this, you know, sort of outtake reel from the 1999 WGBH Boston Health Century with Maurice Hillerman and the historian, the medical historian from Canada. So, you know, go back to that. But there's has anybody heard a follow-up with this headbutting between the Hasidic Jews and Mayor de Blasio? I mean, that just quietly went away, you know, where they were like, we're not going to accept this. It has human diploid cells in it. They won't take the MMR shot. And de Blasio was basically, in effect, saying, we own your body. We'll inject what we want to in there. Mm-hmm. Has anybody heard what happened with that? It just went away from the news.
As far as I know, those mandatory vaccinations are still being enforced. I don't know that that's changed.
Well, the Hasidic Jews in New York were saying no. They're saying this violates our dietary restrictions, and like the last caller said, you know, this comes, you know, it comes, and I was censored by Facebook for posting a meme on this, that, you know, it cannot be denied. You know, Snopes has a page up, which is, and I would like to say the arrogance of science is very evident from the idea that when they mapped the concept of the human DNA, they started calling huge swaths of it junk. And of course, the immediate reaction of the faith community was to say, my creator doesn't make no junk. And sure enough, a decade later, they started saying, no, this is non-coding DNA. And now they're calling it microRNA. And NASA has had to admit, they didn't have a good twin study because the Kelly brothers both flew on two, you know, one was an Air Force pilot, one was a Navy pilot. So they both spent a lot of time up in the stratosphere to make two different paths to be an astronaut. They've both been on orbit, and yet they used them. They didn't have a good control, but they used them to do a detailed epigenomic profile in order to see what the effects were of being on orbit for a year. I think it was Gabby Gifford's husband, Scott Kelly, that spent a year on the space station. And there's been three different articles about that. They don't know how they're going to get to Mars because this creates not only osteoporosis-like conditions where the bone density goes down, but it also creates a epithelial damage, like diabetes condition. And that's in low Earth orbit, below the protection of the Van Allen belts. So what they've admitted to here is that they really were arrogant by saying that, you know, huge swaths of the human genome were junk DNA. And all of these mutagenic chemicals that were being exposed to, like fire retardants, the PFOAs, which recently have been now known to be 700 times more toxic and are causing a lot of nasty cancers in men. So I think, yes, PFOAs, the Teflon-type chemicals, I said this back in the 80s when I heard on TV that you can't have the Teflon pans around your tropical birds. I said, Mom, canary in a coal mine, get those out of our house. And, you know, we've got coal miners in the back of our, you know, ancestry. But anyway, this Maurice Hillerman basically admitted to, laughingly, and it was censored from this documentary. I just recently had another copy of it deleted from online, where he said, I didn't know we were bringing in the AIDS virus at the time. And I think the vaccine industry, or mafia, you might call it, will protect themselves. If they have to, they'll kill people. Frank Zappa was high profile enough to be bringing this up in the early 1980s. And I think he even had a stage play that talked about the Green Monkey connection. And the disinformation was that the green monkeys were being used in Africa to transfuse people's blood. They were using blood from green monkeys to give blood. That was the disinformation. I don't think that was a cover-up to make sure that people didn't realize that the human population was being exposed to this crap from the vaccines, because they could not inactivate some of these micro small particles with formaldehyde, and so they were not being detected. The viruses were too small to have been detected or filtered. And you can go online right now and look up laboratory grade filters. They claim in 2014 to have better filters. So what does that say for all the vaccines designed and built before 2014? They were made and built with defective filters that didn't filter out all of the unwanted proteins and viruses. And so if they're better and it's not fraudulent marketing, and then we've got a dilemma there, you know, that they weren't filtering the stuff. But the big thing, and I haven't seen Mary's Monkey, or what's that documentary? Have you guys seen that? Mary's Monkey or something?
Yeah.
This gets into that, and it connects Lee Harvey Oswald, believe it or not, it's crazy, but it connects Lee Harvey Oswald to labs in Florida and New Orleans. Apparently he was the driver that was driving some of this, and I may have some of these details off. And apparently he was the driver that drove some of these laboratory materials between the labs and this Mary woman's monkey that had that may be the lab technician that discovered these undetectable viruses. I don't know. I haven't got to look at that. I forget what the full name of it is. I don't have the title exactly right there, but
I think you're talking about just retroviruses in general.
Right. Well, and the thing that cinches it is, as Maurice Hellerman says, when he detected this virus and was exposing it to the scientific community, and he, of course, he was advocating for the killed virus polio shot in defiance of those that wanted the live muted virus polio shot. And as we've seen in the last decade, in third world countries from Sri Lanka to Africa, the live virus polio vaccine can mutate and reinfect people because of bad sanitary conditions or being exposed to poop, human poop, in these third world countries. Children play in it or whatever, and the vaccine can mutate back into a pathogen. And so, but during this time when he discovered this, and he said, and he plainly told the Salk vaccine people, look, I think this has potential to cause cancer. And the joke, as he says, was going around at the time that we were going to win the Olympics because of the massive vaccine trials that were going on in the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War. We're supposed to believe that the Soviet Union trusted us to do massive vaccine trials and not experiment on our own population, and that the joke was that we were going to win the Olympics because the Russians would be loaded down with tumors. I mean, this is not a gag reel. This, and as the disinformation calls it out there, when you find the article about it, you'll see what I'm saying. They tried to say, in 2009, they tried to say a zombie meme rears its ugly head again. Well, my copy that just got deleted from Brighteon right after, I don't know exactly when, but after I heard that health ranger guy was being pulled down by a federal order, I went back and looked. And my copy of that is gone off of the Brighteon profile, because that's what I called it, a zombie meme rears its ugly head again if I can help it. That video is not very well done. I've been meaning for years to redo it because the captions that scroll across the bottom are hard to read and they loop some of the audio. What it is a bunch of production people in probably WGBH studios that are watching this video. And they laugh about it. What Mark won't do to develop a vaccine after this Maurice Hellerman, vaccine pioneer, says, I didn't realize we were bringing in the AIDS virus at the time. And I'm sure that's where Frank Zappa ended up dying from an overnight case of prostate cancer, because he was trying to tell everybody this in the early 1980s.
Wow. Okay, we'll be right back after a commercial. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest is Jeremy R. Hammond. Jeremy R. Hammond. His website is jeremyrhammond.com. And, Jeremy, what is your response to what Mike has said?
Well, he brought up a really good point that we didn't have an opportunity to talk about, which is the whole field of epigenetics.
Right.
Where, you know, I remember when I was taught about, you know, what scientists knew about DNA and genetics and stuff, and it was kind of like, well, you know, you have certain DNA, and then that pretty much dictates, you know, certain traits that you're going to have. But we, scientists now know that that's completely false, and that, you know, even if you have, for example, a genetic predisposition for certain outcomes, whatever it might be, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get that disease. And a great example of that is celiac disease. So, you know, 99% of people who have celiac disease have a certain one or both of a pair of genetic alleles. But that doesn't mean that just because they have those genes doesn't mean that they're going to have celiac disease. There's an environmental trigger that's required, which in this case is gluten. And the whole field of epigenetics, you know, we now know that genes can be activated or deactivated. They can be on or off, essentially. And so the environmental factors can activate or deactivate different genes. And so this, and then, you know, genetic, changes that can happen, can be then passed on in into the offspring. And so this opens up a whole new area in a whole new paradigm in terms, you know, when you start thinking about vaccines and their effects on our genetics. It really is a mass uncontrolled experiment that is really frightening, because we are altering the genetics of the human species through vaccination. And we're also altering the genetics of the pathogens. The pertussis bacteria, for example, has evolved so that now, the ones mostly circulating lack a certain, antigen component. So they become vaccine resistant. So one of the key, antigens in the vaccine designed to stimulate an immune response is called protactin. And so, pertussis these days is protactin deficient. And in fact, it's what's evolved to basically escape the protection conferred by vaccines. And, the risk of pathogens evolving to become even more virulent and even more dangerous and deadly, is a real risk. And so scientists are just playing this game with us and treating us as these guinea pigs in this mass uncontrolled experiment. And they have no idea what the consequences could potentially be, down the road, and they could potentially be quite disastrous. And so these are all different considerations that, you know, again, public policymakers just don't even think about these things. It's like they know the science is out there, but they just pretend like it doesn't exist. And they pretend like these aren't legitimate concerns that parents have about all these vaccines, an increasing number, and in still increasing number yet in the pipeline of, you know, vaccine after vaccine that they want to produce and they want to get high uptake for among populations around the world. And the challenge that they're having is that people are resisting. And so they're becoming more and more increasingly authoritarian, trying to force these vaccines down people's throats.
Right. Would you like to stay over into the next hour for a bit?
I won't be able to do that.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you.
And I hope people will download your information and sign up for your list. Thank you so very, very much. Take care.
Thank you for having me on.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.